And our main speaker tonight is Sarah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. It's wonderful to be here. My home group is the Promises Meeting, Fridays at 12:30 at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. All are welcome. And my sobriety date is Bastille Day, July 14th, 1981. So, I should begin by saying that I am enormously grateful to be sober and to be here. And there's a part of me, actually all of me, that never feels more complete or joyful than when I am in a meeting, even if I'm not having a particularly good day. And that is so different from my drinking life. At the end of 19 years of drinking, for those of you who have known me for a while, you know that I was living on a Caribbean island with a pirate. I had retired in my 30s from the most successful business on the island because I found it impossible to hold a drink in one hand and my life in the other. So I did the obvious thing and just put down anything that wasn't a drink. And I often think that the first great miracle in my life that led me here was ever getting off that island, because for those of you who have vacationed on tropical islands and you wonder how the people manage who live there when you're partying and carrying on and you're just there for a week, we did it all the time. And I know that there are people on the island who are long sober, because in the years of my sobriety, I've been back there many times, and there is wonderful sobriety there, but I can assure you I had no idea about that when I lived there. And in general, in my life, over 19 years, you can really sort of hone your address book so there's nobody in it who doesn't drink the way you do. And that is what happened to me. There's a saying that there are three kinds of people in the world: the ones who make things happen, the ones who watch things happen, and the ones who say, "What on earth happened?" And I sort of feel that in the course of my life until I got to AA, I went through those three phases. I grew up in the what you see on TV and hear about, the 50s and 60s, when the world was a very different place. And I had, as far as I knew, sort of a happy childhood. It wasn't until years later that I realized that there was a lot that was, as we say these days, dysfunctional, but it took hindsight to be able to see that. When I was growing up, it was a time, at least in my family, where we were almost from birth expert at something I call the glad game. Nothing was ever wrong. I remember being about, I'm one of five children, and I remember being about, maybe four or five, and stamping my foot and saying to my mother, "I hate my older brother." And she looked me straight in the eye and, with the best intentions of the world, said, "Oh, darling, you don't mean that. You love your brother. That's not how you feel." And so when I later, much later, picked up a drink, I found that I could have all the feelings, particularly the unacceptable ones: the anger, the flirtatiousness, the blame, the wild times, all of the things that were sort of not spoken about or not acceptable in my family. But what was kind of interesting is that I grew up in the outskirts, the suburbs of New York, and my father had grown up poor, and my mother was sort of a lapsed Southern aristocrat. So my father's whole goal in life was keeping up with the Joneses, and my mother was sure we were the Joneses. So even as a kid, there was that sort of clash of reality and never really knowing sort of what was going on, which, when I picked up a drink a bit later in life than my colleagues today started, I was already in college, and I had been a really devoted student, and so I sort of took up drinking as a subject to be learned. And it happened that I was blessed to be able to spend some time in France, and of course there, drinking wine was like conjugating verbs. You know, you had to know how to do that. And so it just kind of progressed from there. And one of the things that I never knew until I got sober is not only that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, but it is also progressive. And the things that I could do when I was 20 or 25 or even 30 in terms of my resilience and my stamina and my enthusiasm for drinking, I simply couldn't keep up when I got a little bit older. And of course, the pirate I lived with had a great motto for life. He said, "We're not here for a long time, we're here for a good time." And despite my excellent education and my pretensions for being a sophisticate and a citizen of the world, I thought that was just absolutely perfect. That just summed up my whole code of living. And in the years that I was on the island, I had always prided myself on being a person, a principled person, a person who had standards. So when I couldn't live up to them anymore, I just lowered them. And I found myself at the end of my drinking really most comfortable in the company of liars, thieves, louts, layabouts, people who I found colorful, because they weren't like anything I had ever known before I got there. But in truth, they were the external reflection of my esteem, where I had come in my drinking, which is not to say anything wrong with any of them. It was just that I could no longer maintain the kind of person I had intended to be, this person who was going to make things happen. And then I became a person who watched things happen. And after 19 years, to my absolute amazement, I was on the sidelines wondering what happened. What happened to this person of promise and joie de vivre and excitement about being alive, who wanted to change the world? And in fact, it was a great cover, because I came into the workforce during the Vietnam War, and I had lost people who mattered to me, and I was fiercely opposed to doing anything that would help what we then called the military-industrial complex, which meant big business. And so I had started working. I answered an ad in the New York Times, and I got a job in something called not-for-profit, nonprofit. I had no idea what that was. And so I began what turned out to be a long career of working for the good of the world. And this turned out to be a fabulous costume for the person I really was as soon as I left my office, who was really only out for me, to have a great time, to do whatever I wanted, to gradually creep into that place that almost every alcoholic I know gets to, where our back is against the wall, but we don't see that. And for me, I was arrogant, I was selfish, I thought, I fly with the eagles, you want to keep up with me, you know, it's my way or the highway. And I was, I thought, a lot of fun. And that was until I just turned on a dime after who knows how many drinks and became really not anybody I would ever want to know today. And that didn't occur to me. I didn't see it. Everybody around me drank the way I did, certainly on the island. And then when I got back to New York, you know how our whole lives can be a complete mess. Hospitalizations, broken relationships, smashed cars, lost jobs. And then it's some tiny, infinitesimal little thing that actually penetrates that gets us sober. So here I am living on this island. I get up at 5 o'clock every day. I have no tan. I have retired from my business so that I could go sailing and have the life of the tropics. And instead, all I did was sleep all day, get up. The pirate sang and played the guitar in the local saloons. So I would go with him to his gig, and then, not to take his inventory, but I do believe he had a little bit of a drinking problem. And after he finished his gig, he wanted what anybody would, which is a drink after work. So there we were at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, still drinking. And the pirate actually had been, before he got to the island, he had been stopped at the border of Mexico with some marijuana. Unfortunately, it was in a plane, and he was the pilot. So they had sent him, as he put it, away to school, and he prided himself. He was from Southern California. He was a fabulous guy and the greatest drinking companion I could ever have hoped for. And he was indignant that here, this hardened criminal smuggler, while he was in jail, all they wanted him to do was go to an AA meeting. He thought this was hysterical. Years later, after I got sober and we would talk about this, I realized that they identified right away what his problem was. And he was more than likely one of us. May he rest in peace. He is no longer walking the earth. But in any event, the seeds of recovery were probably all along my path, but I never saw them. I was, if I say so myself, a gifted drinker. I had an enormous capacity. I had absolutely no barriers. I would drink with anyone, anywhere, anytime, anything. So I was quite well-rounded, we could say. And at the end of my drinking, one day I woke up on my island with a beautiful life, if you looked at it from the outside. And I thought, something is terribly wrong here. I need a job. I was completely unemployable. Nonetheless, I packed a bikini in a pink duffel bag, and I got on a plane, and I came back to New York, where I had managed, in the way we canny alcoholics can do, to keep my apartment in the Village. So I got off the plane. It was Memorial Day, and I lasted 6 weeks in New York with the habits I had picked up in St. Croix before I got 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous. But in that 6 weeks, from Memorial Day to Bastille Day, in the summer of 1981, I watched the entire progression of my despair and my destruction, basically. I had come back to get a job because I was sure that would solve whatever wasn't right in my life. Now, I still went out drinking every night, and I still got up every day about 4 o'clock. And I smoked in those days, or I had just stopped smoking. By the way, cigarettes on St. Croix were 25 cents a pack, and Stolichnaya, which I drank, was $3.25, and Johnny Walker Red, which I drank when I was not drinking Stolichnaya, was $1.75. So God made it all right to drink. It was good for the budget. And so when I got back, I was carrying on my same proclivities. So I would wake up about 4 o'clock groping for the coffee pot, and I would start out knowing I had to make at least one phone call a day to try to get a job. So I would say, good morning, my name is Sarah. My name is Sarah. Hello, my name is Sarah. By this time, I had drunk a pot of coffee, and it was about 5 o'clock, and everybody I wanted to talk to had gone home. So I was making no progress getting a job, and my sister, who had preceded me into Alcoholics Anonymous by a number of years, was my baby sister. And when she got sober, I thought, good thing, that kid really had a problem. And I didn't identify with any of what had prompted her to stop drinking, but in the way that we learn in AA, she was trying to help me. She was way too smart to try to carry the AA message, but she at least introduced me to someone in the field I wanted to get into who would help me with my resume and maybe introduce me to some people. Someone who was in AA, someone who only wanted to help me. And here is what I did. every night that I was going to meet with this woman who had a big job in exactly the place that I wanted to work, I would always think, now I'm going to meet her after work. She doesn't drink. I can't have a drink until after I've met with her. So that's okay because she has a fabulous sense of humor. And I will be laughing so I won't know that I'm not drinking. And then as soon as I'm finished with her, I'll go have a drink. And we had met two or three times, and she was helping me. And right after the 4th of July, we found ourselves at the same big party. And I had had my usual number of drinks. I do not remember what happened at the party, but I know that the next day she called up, and here is what she said. She said, "Sarah, I really have no idea what I must have done to deserve the kind of treatment you displayed to me last night. But if you ever want to talk about that, I just want to tell you that your behavior reminds me of the way I was when I was drinking. And if you'd ever like to talk about that, I hope you will call." Click, and she hung up. And half of me thought, well, get her. Who does she think she is? And the other half of me knew in that way we know that it was done. And that was a Sunday, and we made a commitment to meet on the following Wednesday, 3 days later. So my last drink was actually on Bastille Day night, a Tuesday night, and it was sodden. It was, I probably had cocktails and wine and cognac, which I loved, and nothing happened. I just felt waterlogged, liquor-logged. I didn't feel thrilled. I didn't feel despair. I just felt nothing. And the clincher for me, I was a blackout drinker. I thought the purpose of having friends was so you could take turns telling each other what happened when it was not your night to have the blackout. And so I had always been a blackout drinker. I thought everyone had blackouts. And the day after that party where I had so harmed this woman who ended up 12-stepping me and becoming my first sponsor, I had gone on that Sunday, hangover and all, to a big garden party. And remember, I had been living away from New York for several years. And I was being hosted by a longtime friend of mine. We're on this beautiful garden. And way over there, where I know nobody, I see a group of people and they're waving to my friend. And I turn to Bruce and I say, "Look, there are some friends of yours, they're coming over." And Bruce looks over there and he says, "I don't see anybody I recognize." I said, "Well, I haven't been here, I don't know who they are." And as they got close enough to speak to us, they said, "Sarah, how are you today? What time did you finish dancing on the bar last night?" I did not recognize a single one of them. And in that moment, I knew, along with that phone call, I was done. So I met the woman who would become my sponsor. She carried the message to me. She said, "Can we go to a meeting tomorrow?" Oh, I said, "Oh, no, that's out of the question. I'm going away for the weekend on Thursday, and I won't be back until Tuesday." And she said to me, "Do you think you cannot drink?" And I said, "Well, of course. What do you think I am, an alcohol?" And the word just stuck right in my throat. And I would love to say that from that moment, I got it. From that moment, I never picked up another drink. But it took me about a year coming to meetings, having a sponsor, going to meetings all the time, because as I told you, I was unemployable, so it took a little bit of time to get back into the workforce. I really couldn't get the first step. To me, powerless and unmanageable were words I did not relate to. Unmanageable to me meant my life not looking good, and of course, everything was in place, and I had a tan. And powerless. Now, what would make me feel powerless? I thought, oh, going to the party in someone else's car, me not driving, that would make me feel powerless. I didn't get it at all. But happily, I was able to begin to become familiar with the rest of the steps. Almost from the first, I started going to a Women's 11th Step meeting. It meets on Wednesdays at 5:45 in the McGraw-Hill building across from Radio City. I hope any of you women who are looking to put a little octane in your 11th step or just want to try out a new meeting will come and join us there. And I knew from the look in your eyes and the way you were with each other and the fidelity with which you came to meeting after meeting and the way you reached your hand out to me that this was what I wanted. And it didn't hurt that I was on a pink cloud for a couple of years because we remember that long time, good time. I needed to feel good. And what I have discovered in my sobriety is that while life goes on along the surface, and it certainly has delivered the same things that happen to all of us, deaths, sickness, sadness, job loss, firings, hirings, meeting wonderful people, all of it. Now, my sobriety is like the bottom of the ocean. It does not move. It does not move. It is as solid as anything that I know of in life. And for me, the spiritual part of the program is like the wet part of the ocean. For me, there is nothing about this program of recovery that we share that is not spiritual. Work is spiritual. My relationship with my sponsees is spiritual. When I give service at a meeting, that's spiritual. And I think it is because there is a great spirit that connects us. It's certainly what I feel, and I go to meetings to get reconnected to that. What I've been thinking about lately is resourcefulness. I always am so struck by the resourcefulness of Alcoholics Anonymous that takes the worst things that ever happened to us in our drinking and our bottoms and enables us somehow by this magical alchemy to turn this into the strength and the willingness to change our lives. When I got sober at Perry Street, there was an old guy who says, "Oh yeah, it's very simple. You don't drink, you go to meetings, and you change your whole life." And I did not have any interest in changing my life. I knew that I drank too much, but I was in danger of not being too hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or fabulous. I had spent a great deal of time being fabulous. And I would love to say that I immediately got it, that this is not necessary, but I spent a good 10 or 15 years in sobriety before I realized that not only is being fabulous greatly overrated, it is also expensive and time-consuming. So, as I have stayed in the rooms, and I have always gone to a lot of meetings because it is my way of connecting with the spirit that I love, as I have stayed in the rooms, my life has gotten simpler. Keep it simple is not just a slogan that was up on the wall when I got sober. Keep it simple is something that I say to myself all the time, every day, because it really is related to how important is it. It's related to let go and let God. What a concept. What a concept. Let God do it. And I think about the wonderful counsel that I have gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was about 10 or 12 years sober, I had a marvelous opportunity to do some volunteer work for the General Service Office. And part of that commitment meant making a talk in front of a lot of people who had come from all over the place about a topic. And in this particular case, because of the nature of the meeting, they wanted my remarks in advance. Well, to me, that's like a speech. And I don't know about all of you, but when I speak in AA, it just comes out however it is. It isn't prepared. So somehow the idea of having to write a speech or to write down in advance what I was going to say was very daunting to me. So I called up someone I knew who worked at the General Service Office who had been wonderfully helpful to me, and I talked to him about how panicked I was. What was I going to do? The deadline was 5 o'clock today. I didn't have anything down. People were expecting me to do this, and I wasn't even going to speak until like Friday, and how could they do this to me, and what was I going to do? And got myself into a total tizwiz. And he waited until I was finished, and then he said, "Sarah, I think it is time for me to pass on some wonderful advice I got from a sober woman in Texas." And I said, "And what would that be?" And he said, "Well, she called this the secret." And it was before the secret in the CD that we've all heard. He said, "She called this the secret." And I thought, wow, the secret. I've been waiting my whole sobriety for the secret. What's it going to be? Thank you, Luke. And he said, "It's this. Begin where you are. Do what you can gracefully. Step out in faith. Expect God to help." And I thought to myself, wow. I put down the phone. I looked at where I was, sitting in my office. Begin where you are. I picked up my pencil or my computer keyboard, whatever it was. Do what you can gracefully. Step out in faith. The part I always forget. It's like, I will do this. I will do it. No, step out in faith, expect God to help. So something ended up on that piece of paper. I went to the talk, I gave it, I had a wonderful time. But it was a profound example to me of getting out of my own way. And what is also significant in that for me is that I didn't dream that up sitting in my office with the door closed. Another alcoholic brought that message to me. I still remember what they said to me when I got sober. When you are by yourself, you're listening to an alcoholic. So as I was talking to, I have a wonderful sponsee who happens to live in Paris, and we were on the phone today, and she said, "You know, Sarah, you have this long-term sobriety, and yet you still are going to meetings." And I said, "Yes, I am." And she sort of said, "Well, I don't understand why you do that." And I said, "I go to meetings for the same reason that I drank. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel good." Now, at the end of my drinking, I wasn't feeling so good, but I didn't have any comparison. Drinking was what I did. So I didn't know that it was possible to feel the way I have felt almost from the first moment that I put down a drink and picked up the hand of someone in AA. And I said to my sponsee, "You know how dedicated you are to your," as she pronounces it, Pilates? And she said, "Oui, oui." And I said, "That makes you feel good. So you go, even when it's raining, when you don't feel like it, when you've had a bad day." And she said, "Yes." And I said, "It's not so different from the reason that I go to AA. There are many more profound reasons to be at a meeting whenever I go." But I also remember one of the early important messages of my first few years when someone said to me, "You cannot be depressed and grateful at the same time." So the best antidote I have for living a joyful life where I feel engaged and enthusiastic and happy and not depressed or anxious or suffering from what Bill calls in the big book anxious apartness, is to come to a meeting. And the longer I've stayed sober, I will tell you, people say to me, "Well, what's it like?" I mean, I realize I'm longer sober than some of you have been walking on the earth. And thank you. And I think the sense that I have in my life is that the volume is lower. The volume is lower. And I am much less important than I once was to myself. And to the degree that that has liberated me to give service or to be helpful to someone else, to reach out my hand, to share and carry the message. That's really kind of what counts. And it's just been marvelous to be here with you all tonight, and I thank you for the gift of our shared sobriety.